Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. And I'm Carola Böhm.
And I'm Richard McCarthy.
At the moment, of course, what's happening in the European Union is that the discussions and the negotiations of the top jobs are going on. And I have to admit, I found that quite confusing. But I think what it actually shows is that, of course, you know, as we've said before, the European Union has been evolving gradually through treaty after treaty. And I think this governance system has emerged, which is in itself quite unique. You know, you don't have any other country where you have such sensitive negotiations, where you balance the diversity of political opinion, as well as gender, as well as size, as well as, you know, left, right, wing, east, west.
You know why?
Why?
Because Europe isn't a country.
That's right.
But, you know, and a lot of people will be annoyed with the idea of talking about it like that, because it isn't a country. You know, we've just had the Brexit people turning their backs on the national anthem because the national anthem, they say, is for countries.
Yeah, but I mean, that makes it unique, doesn't it? You know, this, and as we said before, you know, the sensitive balance between sovereignty and unity in forming a relationship, a network, an ecosystem of countries where there's this balance of being able to work together, but at the same time respecting each other's sovereignty. And I think it is a negotiation, it is a give and take, you know, so I think that's why they look at the top jobs as a cluster, because they can negotiate, okay, if we can decide on this person in this role, then let's, you know, we would be willing to do this on that role.
And we're here to talk to you about, well, eventually, about Chapter 5 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, which is citizens' rights, which is largely about voting, it seems. But we're also going to be talking about the top jobs in the EU, which have been negotiated or argued about or discussed in great depth this week in the EU.
I was actually quite confused.
Yeah. Well, most people are, I think.
Yes. And, you know, some media outlets suggested there are three top jobs. Some said there were four top jobs. And some of them are, of course, decided by the European Council, some of them by the European Parliament. Some of them are still open now as we speak. Some of them have already been agreed upon. So what we thought would be useful, I put everything into a spreadsheet.
No, great spreadsheet it is too.
And the links are in the show notes. And it certainly clarified something for us. You know, we're not experts. We're not political wonks. So it's us trying to figure out by doing this podcast.
Yeah. And hopefully, and we can share it with you, listeners.
Yes, exactly. So there are five top jobs, I would suggest, which have all been coming up just recently and are still being decided as we speak. One is the President of the European Commission, then two, President of the European Council, three, President of the European Parliament, four, High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, and then five, President of the European Central Bank.
Yeah. So should we talk about the first one then?
Yeah.
Okay, the first one is the President of the European Commission. Apparently the most powerful position in the EU. They seem to, as you've put here, speak on behalf of Europe when they're talking. And presently, that's Jean-Claude Juncker, who...
we know from the Brexit negotiations.
Absolutely,
well.
That's right.
And that person gets appointed by the European Parliament.
Right. So appointed by the European Parliament, but...
But at the moment it has been put forward, the nominee has been put forward by the European Council.
Yeah. So they get decided on by the European Council, and then they get that name goes to the European Parliament, and the European Parliament gets to say yes or no.
Yeah, decided is maybe the wrong word.
And I don't know, they negotiate and come up with a name finally.
A nominee.
So they sort of say, this is who, overall, we can all agree on this person. How about you, Parliament? What do you think?
And then, of course, the President of the European Council is perceived to be, you know, the strategist. This post is usually a sort of former head of state.
Mm-hmm. And the European Council, let's just be clear on that. That's the group of the leaders of the European nations.
And at the moment, that's Donald Tusk. So again, a very familiar name, also one of the Brexit negotiating team members. But this post, President of the European Council, is appointed by the European Council by qualified majority.
Okay, and the qualified majority is that that person needs the support of 72% of the 28 member states, which must represent more than 65% of the population.
And that person gets appointed only for 2.5 years. It can be renewed, whereas, of course, the president of the European Commission gets appointed for 5 years. And again, it's renewable.
Okay.
But the president of the European Council has actually been appointed. So it's now been decided that Charles Michel from Belgium, who's the interim prime minister from Belgium, is going to be the president of the European Council.
Oh, right. Okay.
Centre-left.
Okay. Centre-left. So it's switched from Donald Tusk was EPP, who's centre-right. So the new guy is with...
ALDE.
Okay, who are, like you said, centre-left.
And of course, this is the post which before 2009 shifted almost on a half-yearly basis. And it was sort of part-time and Tony Blair was it and, you know, some famous names would. And now it's 2.5 years at a time. And
yeah, it did seem a bit strange at the time because you'd have thought in 6 months they'd only just get into position before they could start trying to do something. And then suddenly they're not the president anymore. So
yeah. So the third position is president of the European Parliament. And of course, the European Parliament is the parliament of MEPs. You know, we've just had European Parliament elections.
Mm-hmm.
And that post is perceived to be articulating the EU's values. You know, I guess the equivalent to the UK political system is like the Speaker of the House of Commons.
Okay, right. But maybe not quite as loud as the Speaker of the House of Commons.
Not the such Doesn't booming do the voice. Whole... Right, okay.
Okay, so the former person was Antonio something beginning with T, who was EPP once again.
Antonio Tajani.
Tajani.
From Italy.
Okay, and now it is David Sassoli from...
Italy.
Italy again.
And from the S&D, so centre-left.
Okay, so switch there as well.
Yeah, and that post, that's one of the longest posts. So it's been in place since 1952.
Okay.
And yeah.
Yeah, obviously it makes sense that if you've got a European Parliament, that you have somebody at the head of the European Parliament, maybe.
There are quite a lot of Italians who hold that post. You know, I sort of counted up, you know, some of the last ones, you know, and over the last few years, Italy had the most, then Germany, then France, then Belgium, then Spain.
Right, okay.
But, you know, it just shows again, you know, they're trying to do this balance between different kinds of aspects of governance.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. So that person specializes in bilateral relations, international relations.
Okay.
And that person gets appointed to 5 years at a time. That person is somehow linked to the President of the European Commission because that person has to be agreed upon with the consent of the President of the European Commission. Because I assume the President of the European Commission and the High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs will have to work very closely together.
Okay, so it's the person they are appointed, it's the European Council who elect them, but they've got to have the consent of the actual president of the Commission.
Yeah, exactly.
As well.
Yeah. So that's where it gets quite complicated. And when I heard media who, you know, some media report one role, some media report the other role, it just did my head in. So, you know, I think the spreadsheet does lay it out quite nicely.
Right.
And the person who had the position was Federica Mogherini. But the person who is now nominated, so has not been yet
Federica
agreed.
Mogherini.
Yes, sorry, it's a woman.
Say Federica whether it's a woman or a man.
Mogherini.
Yeah.
She's a woman, Federica Mogherini. So she held the position until now. And from Italy, again. And the person who will now has been nominated is Josep Borrell.
Who's Spanish.
Yeah, so he's left. So that's another left-ish SP.
Okay.
And then the last person who gets appointed every 8 years.
Okay.
Is the president of the European Central Bank.
Yeah. And that used to be Mario Draghi.
Yes.
Where's he from?
Italy.
Italy again. Italy were getting a lot, weren't they?
But, you know, because it's an eight-year post, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it just happens that this post comes up now as well.
And this is, in a way, a bit separate from the others because it's not really such a political post.
Exactly. But that person will be responsible for the euro, for the monetary policy in the eurozone. So, of course, it's tightly hooked up to some of the policies that they might decide upon. But, yes, it's slightly less day-to-day political. It's much more day-to-day, you know, monetary policy.
Yeah. You've got to be capable of being a bank manager type of job.
Yeah, and those 8 years are non-renewable. So we said the president of the European Commission, who's been appointed for 5 years, it's renewable. So you could have somebody serving 10 years, whereas the president of the European Central Bank is non-renewable, is 8 years.
Right. Okay.
And that person, the nominee, is Christine Lagarde from EPP, so center right, and the entity that appoints them is the president of the European Commission. So again, it's linked to the president of the European Commission. So there are two posts, and that's why sometimes you get the top jobs, the three top jobs. So the president of the European Commission, who has to consent to the High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs, and also approves the president of the European Central Bank. So that's why those three, who at the moment all are open for negotiation and still have to be confirmed, but they are linked.
Okay.
So those are the top jobs.
Okay, so 5 potential top jobs.
And of course, it is actually quite important because these individuals are nominated by elected officials. And that's I'm trying to smoothly move over to chapter 5, citizens' rights, which is all about right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And stand as candidates.
It's important because I know that my parents have always argued that, the EU is non, it's just run by a bunch of people who aren't elected and blah, blah, blah. And that's not true.
Yeah.
So, well, I don't know if it was true 20 years ago, but certainly now it's not true. And these people, they haven't been directly elected by people, but they are put in place by the people that we have elected. And, you know, in the UK, for example, the person who has the job of in number 11 is not elected by the people directly. It's somebody put in place
by the
whoever's in number 10 normally.
Or as we have at the moment, you know, the next prime minister is going to be elected by only Conservative Party members and not by...
Not by the people.
Not by the people
of the UK.
In terms of this issue of is the EU democratic or not, you know, because there's always this notion of these individuals are not elected. As you said, they're being negotiated by the leaders of state or by the European Parliament who are elected. So I don't have any problem with that. The president of the European Commission, quite often there's a sort of suggestion that it's not democratic because it happens behind closed doors. So I would suggest there's an issue with transparency, but there's not an issue with democracy because, again, it's the elected leaders of the individual countries who negotiate amongst themselves to see who can take this role forward.
And our cabinet meets behind closed doors and they're not supposed to reveal what happens behind those closed, you know, they're not supposed to talk about the nitty-gritty stuff, just come out with what decisions are made. So I don't see how that's any different from our own government and the government of any other country in the EU, I expect.
And I do think what is actually quite nice, you know, we just laid out who comes from centre-right, centre-left, you know, these kind of things, you know, which countries they come from. And I find it quite fascinating how, again, there's this balance just by these 5 top jobs. You can see this very sensitive but intentional effort to maintain balance between different aspects of the European Union, and specifically the balance between sovereignty of the individual nation states balanced with unity.
Yeah.
Right, chapter 5, citizens' rights.
Okay, so Article 39 is the right to vote and stand as a candidate at elections to the European Parliament. Number 1 has every citizen in the Union has the right to vote and to stand as a candidate at elections to the European Parliament in the member state in which he or she resides under the same conditions as nationals of that state. And I would say that didn't happen in Britain this time around, because so many EU nationals were denied the ability to vote because, according to the UK government, suddenly the UK government wanted them to have some proof that they weren't going to be voting in their country that they were living in before they came here.
Well, it was a very tight deadline. But, you know, yes, there have been a lot of issues. At the same time, some of the postal votes, as we know, received a Brexit voting campaign leaflet within their...
Oh, really? Yes. I didn't know that. Blimey.
Yes. So it was a bit of a mess.
A lot of the Brexit ones posted out... Well, sorry, a lot of the ones posted out didn't arrive in time for people abroad to vote on time. So that messed things up.
The one thing that I did look up to this article, you know, every citizen of the Union has the right to vote and to stand as a candidate at elections. We know, of course, that, for instance, I would be able to stand for the European Parliament, although I'm not able to stand for the Westminster Parliament. But because I'm a European citizen and I'm living still in a member state in which I reside, I, in the same conditions as nationals of that state, like yourself, you can also stand for MEP for Britain. We could both stand for MEPs as being an MEP for the European Parliament for Britain, whereas I'm a German citizen and you're a British citizen.
Yeah.
So the definition, of course, then a citizenship, and not, you know, I know that there is a petition at the moment going on which tries to create a permanent European citizenship. So once a citizen, always a citizen. Just similar to my German citizen, I'm a German citizen. Unless I revoke it, I remain a German citizen. And there's a suggestion that that goes also for the European citizenship. But, you know, I think it's a complicated matter. But the definition of citizenship in this context is an individual holding the nationality of a member state. Yeah. So I will remain being a European citizen because I'm of the German nationality. German.
Yeah. Whereas yes. I won't be because I'll be British.
Yeah.
And I understand how British people who are wanting to stay in Europe would like to stay as EU citizens forever. But I don't think it makes sense for that to happen, because it means that potentially there could be a good 30 million people being supported by the EU who aren't putting any money into the EU. And it could come into conflict with between the EU and Britain. We might say, oh, I'm a EU citizen, you can't treat me like that. And then British government would say, yeah, but you're a British citizen. Oh, well, you're a British, not citizen, but you're a British subject. So we're going to treat you like this, because that's how we treat British subjects. So a lot worse.
Oh,
so
I
think it makes sense.
You're going to have to go through those.
We shouldn't be allowed to be EU citizens unless we are... Unless we get joint nationality with another country that's in the EU.
You're referring to those dreaded queues. You're going to be able to have to queue in long, long lines, whereas I'm going to dance through the European.
Saunter through.
Right. And then there's a second paragraph here. Members of the European Parliament shall be elected by direct universal suffrage in a free and secret ballot. Because direct means that we're just directly electing the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, and universal suffrage simply means that irrespective of race, wealth, age, except it suggests, you know, except of course it has to be adult age.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So Article 40 then was the right to vote and to stand as a candidate at municipal elections, which we're taking to mean local elections.
Yep.
And we thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense, that because even though people can't vote, say EU citizens in Britain can't vote for members of parliament, we thought that's because that's a more important role, whereas they can vote for in local elections because that's very important to them anyway, because that's it manages things that they're doing around where they are, but it isn't as important to the whole country. Doesn't affect the whole country so much.
That's what this article brought in, that everyone has the right, you know, if there is a, you know, yes, individuals can vote for European Parliament elections, but everyone also is allowed because there's no mobility. People can move around, work across the whole of the European Union. And because you're then resident in one area, you should be able and pay tax in that one area. You should be able to vote locally in that area.
Mm-hmm. So did it bring it in or was it there anyway?
I might lose the right to vote in local elections.
Mm.
So that means what I didn't realize is that this law is also in jeopardy, that in some states which don't have in their own national law the ability to vote in local elections by residents, that the UK citizens who are then post-Brexit, who are outside of the European Union, would lose their right to vote into local elections.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and according to Wikipedia, in terms of, I was looking up, let's see what the headline of this is, Right of Foreigners to Vote. Let's see, it's got a sort of map of Europe, coloured according to the right of non-EU residents, resident foreigners to vote in each country. So after Brexit, EU nationals will be just like any other national in the UK. And that says that countries according right to vote, so we would allow people to vote as long as they're a member of the Commonwealth.
Wow, so
in local election. So you will lose the right to vote in a local election, even though you're the person paying taxes and I'm not in our household.
Gosh, that's...
So you won't be able to vote for an MP. You won't be able to vote for in local elections, even though you pay money to the government, you pay in your taxes, you pay money to the local government in your taxes, but you won't have any control over, you know, you won't have a vote in that at all, should Brexit happen.
Gosh, that is horrific.
Which is really poor.
And similarly, if you go to Germany, if we do move back to Germany...
Mm-hmm.
Countries from the European Union which do not give the right to vote to non-EU foreigners. You couldn't vote in the local elections either.
Yeah, well, I could understand more because I'm not, I suppose I would then be paying taxes to, I wouldn't be paying taxes to the EU though.
Well,
my government wouldn't be.
Well, you could work, you could get...
I know, I'd be working and I'd... So then maybe I'd be in the same situation as you, that I wouldn't, I'd be paying German taxes, but I wouldn't be able to vote in Germany.
But look at Scandinavia, the whole of Scandinavia, Finland, Norway, Sweden, as well as Denmark. It's based on residency.
Right, which makes so much sense.
Yeah, also Netherlands, and as far as I can see, Belgium. Right, so that's gone. Right to vote and to stand as a candidate in municipal elections is gone after Brexit.
Yeah, rubbish.
Right.
But there we go.
Article
41. Right to good administration.
So that the administration which handles all sorts of things, it's all to do with EU institutions, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So basically it just means that everything ought to run smoothly and accurately. It should be handled impartially, done fairly, done in a reasonable time. If something happens to you as a result of a bad decision, then they're supposed to make good any damage.
Yeah.
You can write, a good thing is that you can write to the institutions of the union in one of the languages of the treaties, and you've got to have an answer in the same, answer back in the same language.
And then the next article is sort of similar, right of access to documents. So any citizens of the Union has a right of access to European Parliament, Council and Commission documents. And of course, you know, that's what we are using at the moment. There's a wealth of documents to learn about the European Union.
Which is great.
Fabulous.
And presumably that all happens in your own native language as well.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Article 43 is the Ombudsman. And then Article 44 is there.
It's interesting that it's called an Ombudsman and not an Ombudsperson.
Yeah. Article 44, right to petition. So if anybody has the right to put a right to petition the European Parliament or any member, any citizen of the Union.
Mm-hmm. Article 45, freedom of movement and of residence. So every citizen of the Union has the right to move and reside freely within the territory of the member states. And of course, that's a really important one and a big loss after Brexit.
Mm.
And there's a second paragraph. Freedom of movement and residence may be granted in accordance with the treaty establishing the European Community to nationals of third countries legally resident in the territory of a member state.
I think if we just look at it, if we stop thinking about territories and we just look at it, what it says it may be granted in accordance with the treaty established by the European Community to nationals of third countries, so countries outside of the EU, so people who belong to a different country who are legally resident in the territory, doesn't have to be in the actual, in one of the territories of a member state. So a Nicaraguan living in Portugal could be granted. So basically it means anybody could get the grant, could be granted.
Or a Russian living in the Falkland Islands.
Mm-hmm. Could be given freedom of movement and residence.
Right. Okay. And then Article 46, which is the last one, is diplomatic and consular protection.
Yeah, which is quite a cool one, I think.
Do you
shall
read
I read it?
It
the whole thing? It's not long. Every citizen of the Union shall, in the territory of a third country in which the member state of which he or she is a national is not represented, be entitled to protection by the diplomatic or consular authorities of any member state on the same conditions as the nationals of that member state. So if, for example, I'm British and if Britain fell out with Russia and so the Russians said, OK, Britain, you've got to take all your consular people back. They're not allowed in Russia now. And then I got into trouble with the Russian authorities. I could appeal to the French council or the Germans or any other EU nation state, and they ought to kind of look after me in the same sort of way that the British consul would do.
Of course, that's nice on paper.
Yeah, whether it happens in real life or not is another matter.
Right, so that's...
Okay.
Chapter 5.
Chapter 5. Cool.
Right, so we have two chapters to go. One is a big one, justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's
well, it's not a big... Oh, it's important, but it's not big. It's important, but not long.
Yeah, so it's just one page. And then there's the last one, which is general provisions, which, of course...
encompasses everything.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so that's it, and it's time for us to say goodbye. You'd be thinking, yeah, it was time for you to say goodbye a long time ago.
So if you've enjoyed the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player.
And goodbye for now. She always does this every time. She says goodbye for now and looks at me as though I know what she's got written down on her computer. Say next.
I don't
so,
have a
what next, Carola?
Well, I should actually say, feel free to follow us on Twitter, on Dithering on the Edge, @DitheringE. So we've got a Twitter, and we actually put onto Twitter also that spreadsheet about the 5 top jobs.
Yeah.
Goodbye for now, and have a fabulous week.
Okay, bye.